We're having a special class on the topic of Shadim. Before we begin, I have to say a disclaimer, the limitations of our class. In fact, in texts in Chazal, we find multiple terminology. We have the word shade. We have the word ruach. Yeah. We have a few other terms we'll see as we continue. And we have the term mazik. We will assume for now that they are all the same, even though they are not, and we'll deal with them as equals. In fact, if we had more time, we would go more in depth and try to understand what is a mazik, what is a ruach, what is a shade. A ruach is a spirit, a shade they translate today as demons. A mazik is something that harms. What are all of these? So we'll start. We'll try to get some kind of picture. So the extraordinary thing, we also have Satan, right? Satan appears in prophets. Satan omed al yamino l'sitino in the prophet Zechariah. Okay, let's begin. In the end of the Torah, we have a song. And the song is in Parashat Ha'azinu. In that song, Moshe recounts how the Jewish people will veer off the path of the Torah. And he describes different pagan acts that the Jews will do. And he says, Yizbechu, they will even sacrifice Lashedim. That's where we find the term shade in Tanakh, in the Torah. They will sacrifice to Shedim, which, for lack of a better word, will translate as demons. Lo Eloah! What does Lo Eloha mean? They are not a force. So the Targum translates it as they sacrifice to Shedim Dilet Behon Tziroch. Now the word Tziroch, people sometimes think it means they are unnecessary. But Rav Eliyahu Mizrahi writes it means they have no force. People sacrifice to these beings called Shade, even though they have no force. The Targum Yerushalmi translates it as Dilet Behon Mamash. They have no essence. The Targum Yonasan translates it as Dilet Behon Mida'am. There is nothing to them. Okay? So we have three different translations, whether Shedim have no force, they have no essence, there is nothing to them. Yet we have a Mishnah in Tractate Avos. The Mishnah in the fifth chapter of Pirkei Avot writes that on twilight of Friday, Hashem created Mazikin. The commentaries quote a Medrash that the time came for Shabbos to enter. And Hashem created these souls. But Hashem did not have a chance to create a body for these souls. And those souls became what's known as Mazikin. Are Mazikin the same as Shadim? Well, that remains to be seen. The Talmud in Tractate Brachos, when we start the Shas, so in the fifth page, the Talmud tells us, if the eye could only see what was going on around it, so then we'd all flip out. No one would be able to get up because all around us, the Gemara says, has on his right 10,000 Mazikim and 1,000 on his left. What are these mazikim? Maybe they're germs. I don't know. So that's mazikim. Let's go back to Shadim. So the Ibn Ezra writes, the reason they are called Shadim is because they are fears. They are fears, intellectual, psychological fears that come from one's mind. Shed comes from the word shod. Shod means to take by force. So when one's mind is taken, so that's the idea of a shade, says the Ibn Ezra. Now the Ibn Ezra was a Kabbalist, even though his commentary is very literal. Nachmanides writes, the reason they are called Shedim is because they are located in desolate places. places that have been destroyed. So, again, we have the concept of shade corresponding to destructive force. Ibn Ezra says it is a destructive force on one's mind. Ramban says it is a creature that's found in areas of destruction. What is a shade? So at first glance, we look at the Talmud in Tractate Chagiga. Talmud tells us six things we are taught about a shade. In three ways, they are like angels. In three ways, they are like humans.
Are you saying shade?
That's, yeah. That's correct. The three ways that they are like angels, the Talmud says, is they have wings like angels. Angels have wings? I didn't know that. Okay, so the prophet in Ezekiel tells us they have wings. I should have known that, right? But does that mean literally wings? We always understood, like Maimonides explains, that the term wings is a way of saying they're light. Okay, whatever. So shadim have wings. And they fly like angels. And they hear what's coming in the future like angels. That's what the Talmud says. And then there are three things that they're human-like. They eat and drink like humans. They procreate like humans. And they die like humans. Ooh, now we know where the demon slayer came from, yeah? They die like humans. So what's going on here? There is a suggestion by a Kabbalistic work called Maasei Hashem that he says it could be that the shadim come from the souls of the wicked that have passed. When a person has been very wicked in his lifetime, so it could be that his soul and his body come back in the form of that evil creature called a shade. What can a shade do? So, the Talmud actually in Tractate Sanhedrin discusses how did Pharaoh's sorcerers, how were they able to do all their sorcery? So the Talmud delineates some of the sorcerers used shadim. Okay. That certainly sounds like shadim are this creature. But we began with the verse. When the verse talks about shadim, what does the verse say? They sacrifice to shadim that have no strength, they have no force. Meaning we began with the source in Torah that says that shadim really have no force. That's what we started with. So what's going on here? Nachmanides says that the idea here is that you can't get anything good out of a shade. People would sacrifice. It says that in Egypt people would drink blood and sacrifice blood and they'd make pools of blood, all in honor of these demons. And the Torah is coming and telling you, you can't get anything out of it. Even though they know what's yet to come, they know the future, but you can't benefit anything. And the Torah says they have no force, so there's no reason to sacrifice to them. But Nachmanides is working with the understanding that there's this being that exists called a shade, because that's also the literal understanding of the Talmud and Tractate Chagiga. We said, in three ways they are human-like, in three ways they are angel-like. But it doesn't necessarily have to be understood that way. The Talmud says a person can have a dream which is true, a person can have a dream which is false. One verse says God speaks to prophets through dreams, another verse says dreams are filled with lies. Which one is it? So the Talmud says, well, it depends. If your dream came through an angel, then it's a truthful dream. If your dream came through a shade, then it's filled with lies. What do we see? Shadim are a factor in the mind. And this is where the opinions in Chazal will diverge. We will see that one approach says, yeah, there are these creatures out there. I'm looking around the classroom. I don't know which of you are people and which of you are shadim. I have no way of knowing right now, right? Talmud gives us a formula how to figure it out, but right now I don't know. That's one understanding. The other understanding says, don't think there are any shadim out there. The only place there can be shadim are in here. Shadim exist in the mind. And we will look at the sources and we'll see how these two approaches evolve. So there were two understandings among the commentaries. One understanding says there are these creatures, just like there are angels. And then the other understanding says, no. Don't expect to see a shade walking over there. If you see him walking over there, it's not because he's there, it's because there's a problem up here. And shade is a problem in the mind. Shade is not something that's happening external to the person. Two approaches. Now, in Chazal, we often find the term, the person behaved as though he was taken. Kimi shekifao shade. The Talmud in numerous places uses that term. As though he wasn't in control of his actions, it was as though he was, how do they say it in English? Possessed. Right? Okay, so the term in Hebrew, possessed, in Hebrew the Talmud says, kimi shekifao shade, which can mean either a shade subdued him, or a shade forced him to do it. But either one can play itself out with both interpretations. The Talmud says, what happens if someone was forced to eat matzah? Did he fulfill his obligation of eating matzah? The Talmud asks, who forced him? Did a shade force him? The Talmud says, if it's a shade that forced him, listen to the line of reasoning, we have a braisa, we have a Tanakh quote that says, if you have a person that is sometimes sane and sometimes insane, so then when he's sane, all the mitzvahs that he does, it's as though he did them. And when he's insane, so then, okay, whatever he did, it's like a person who's insane did it. So he has this dual status. What do we see from this line in Talmud? The Talmud seemed to align the idea of a person being possessed by a shade with the idea of someone being insane. So this line in Talmud is certainly supportive of the understanding that shade is not a demon. Don't look over your shoulder. He's not there. He's here. Well, we hope not, right? Okay. So we see here that a person who is taken by a demon, who is possessed, is referred to in the Talmud as someone who is not sane, not with it. The Medrash, going back to that verse in Ha'azinu, so the Medrash says, if they'd worship the sun or the moon or the stars, something that is necessary for the world, and something that benefits the world, then Hashem wouldn't be doubly angry at them. But they're worshiping something that doesn't benefit them, that can only harm them. They're worshiping the shade. And what can a shade do? Enter a man and take control of him. So that line in Talmud, again, sounds very supportive. A, it's telling us a shade could harm. That's a little different than what we saw until now. The Talmud tells us, in Tractate Megillah, Joshua was standing opposite the city of Jericho. We just learned this week. It's nighttime. They're in the process of preparing for war. He looks up and he sees a man with his sword outstretched. And Joshua asks him, are you one of ours or are you from the enemy? And he says, no, I'm an angel of God. Yahushua bows to him. The Talmud asks, how did Yahushua bow to him? We are taught that a person has to be careful at night. Don't just greet strangers at night. You have to be concerned. Maybe it's a shade. Oh, wait, that sounds like shadim are walking around here at night, right? Don't just greet people at night. Who knows? Maybe it's a shade. The Talmud says, no. He said, I am an angel of Hashem. So the Talmud asks, but maybe the shade is lying. The Talmud answers, we have a tradition. Shadim won't use Hashem's name in vain. What do we see in that line in Talmud? Certainly sounds the other way. Sounds like you're walking down the street. Someone says, good evening, sir. You better run. Right? Maybe he's a shade. Doesn't sound so good. Okay, we have street lights. We won't see that, but there are sources in Talmud that says they don't like places that are well lit. They don't like public places. They don't like when two people are together. Then they don't bug them. Now we have a line in Talmud that is difficult. Talmud says, we know, introduction, before we get to the Talmud, intro. Torah cares for people. The rabbis care for people, right? So one of the areas in halacha where we bend over backwards and we do everything we possibly can is to prevent tremendous pain from people. And the Talmud tells us that one of the things that causes tremendous pain to a person is a wife who is held in limbo, what's called in halacha aguna. A woman that doesn't know, is my husband alive or dead? Should I remarry or should I hold out and wait for him? He might come back one day. Am I currently married or am I a widow? So that's what's called an aguna, a woman who is held in captivity. The Talmud says, really, her pain is so bad, we should overwrite the law and say, you don't have to be in such pain, get remarried, even if your husband's alive. But we can't do it, because one of the prohibitions you have to give up your life for is committing adultery. And if we were to tell her, go get remarried, when she's actually, in fact, married, her husband's still alive, we would be telling her to commit adultery. And because adultery is so severe that you have to give up your life, we can't go that far. But in fact, the Talmud went as far as the Talmud could to try and free a woman, to try and ensure that she gets divorced. Now, this is a tricky thing, because the whole idea of marriage is that you have a system which you can trust. If you make it too easy to get out of marriage without doing it legally correct, then you've destroyed the whole marriage. Chazal were very careful where they set up the system so that if you want a divorce, you have to do it right. And if you're going to play games, it won't work. And yet, we have this one instance where a woman cannot do it right. She might end up spending years and maybe her whole lifetime in limbo. And so Chazal went very, very far to help her. So those are the two sides of the coin. On the one hand, whenever it comes to marriage and divorce, Chazal were very stringent because they wanted us to do it right. They didn't want it to become a game. It had to be very serious. Now, a guy called me this week. He said, I asked him, are you ready to get married? He said, yes. I said, do you have a wedding ring? He said, yes, two. I said, why do you need two? He said, I'm giving my wife and she's giving me. I said, fine. Traditionally, when you marry a woman, you're giving her the ring. You're taking responsibility to take care of her, etc. You want to wear a wedding ring. You want her to give it to you? So she can do that a day before the wedding. She can do that after the wedding. At the wedding, if you give her a ring under the chuppah and she gives you a ring, you disqualified the wedding. You're not married to her. Because there's a system that the Torah set up and we have to adhere to that system. Part of that system is you show her you cherish her. You give her the ring. You give her the gift. It's not an exchange of gifts. And if you do, you're not halachically married. In Orthodox Judaism, you're not married to her. So we have these two sides of the coin. On the one hand, we're careful with the system. On the other hand, we bend over backwards to try and free a woman. She shouldn't be bound unnecessarily by the system. Now listen to the following Mishnah. That's why I said this is very difficult. The Mishnah says, you're walking in the wilderness. It's evening, and there's a pit. And as you walk next to that pit, you hear a yell. And the guy says, I'm dying! Help me! And you lean down and you don't see anyone. It's a very deep pit. And you have no rope and you have nothing. And he says, I'm going to die in a minute. I don't know how to swim and there's water down here. And you say, what can I do? You can't die to save him, right? And he says, no one's going to find me out here. There are so many pits out here. I'm Chaim Yankel from the city of Uzbekistan. And I'm married to Sprintza that lives in the house, the corner house, right next to the shul. And please at least tell her, go be my messenger and divorce her. She shouldn't spend the rest of her life not knowing if I'm alive or dead. Who are you again? Chaim Yankel. What's the city? You write down all the information. Says the Mishnah, you can go and tell the courts, he appointed me as his messenger, to write a divorce contract for his wife. So now if he ever made it out of the pit alive, well, she's divorced. If he died, she's a widow. She's free to get remarried. So far, so good. Makes sense, right? So ask the Gemara, what are you doing going and writing again? Maybe it was a shade. The Gemara says, you didn't see anyone down there. You don't know who was down there, right? You didn't see. You saw a pit. You heard a voice. So who told you?
So the Gemara says, no, you saw him, and it looked like a man. So the Gemara says, what does that help you? Shadim also look human. They can take on human form. That's why I said, I don't know who's human here and who's a shade. I began with that. I don't know. So the Gemara says, how can she write a divorce? Maybe it was a shade that spoke to you. The Gemara says, you saw his shadow. You saw his shadow, what the Gemara says, bivua. If you saw his shadow, the Gemara says, shadim also have shadows. So the Gemara says, no, you saw the shadow on the shadow of the shadow. When a person's in the sun, there's the dark shadow, and then there's a lighter shadow outside that. And that we have, the Gemara says, maybe they have that too. So the Gemara says, no. Rabbi Chanina says, my son Jonathan taught me, I don't know where his son learned it from, that they have a shadow, they don't have the shadow of the shadow. Then the Gemara goes into other questions and answers. But you see, the Gemara asked, maybe it's a shade. So the Gemara took this very seriously because the Gemara was questioning, how do you free the woman? Of course I want to free the woman. Our interest is to free the woman. And yet the Gemara asked a serious question. The Gemara said, how do you write that divorce contract? I'm not going into the halacha, the actual applications of halacha, take into account that question. Because what did the Gemara just tell me? You saw that he has a shadow and you didn't see a double shadow. Pause. What do we understand by inference? What happens if you didn't see the shadow? What happens if you only heard the voice? What did the Gemara just tell me? Then you can't go. You have to worry it's a shade. Why do I have to worry it's a shade? When was the last time I met a shade? So the answer is, you don't know. Didn't check everyone's shadows here, right?
What does the double shadow mean?
Walk out into the sun tomorrow morning and look. I hope you'll have to.
I hope so.
So how do we know... how do we know? So the Gemara here is telling me if you don't see a double shadow, it could be a shade. You have to see a double shadow. I'll read you the halacha in Shulchan Aruch, and that's where it gets troubling. Shulchan Aruch tells us if you're walking in the desert and you hear a voice say, before I continue, I just want to tell you a story, okay? The Talmud says, if you hear kids talking and saying, the Levaya of Yankel Cornfield will be tonight at 9 o'clock, everyone should please come to the funeral service. The Levaya of Yankel Cornfield will be tonight at 9 o'clock, everyone should come to the funeral service. You guys hear that? You hear that siren going around here? Cars go around with that announcement for different people. So the Talmud says, let's say you hear your kids saying that. Can you go to Yankel Cornfield's wife and tell her, look, if my kids are saying it, they must have been somewhere where they heard that he died. You know, there was a ruckus, there were the Crusades, there were a lot of things going on. No one knows, but the kids wouldn't just make it up. So the Talmud says, you cannot do that because maybe they named their pet worm Yankel Cornfield. And when he died, they played that game. So I read that Gemara and I said, that didn't sit well with me. Until about 5 years ago, I'm sitting outside watching the kids, and I hear my eldest boy go yelling out to the other kids, the Levaya of Yankel Cornfeld will be tonight at 9 o'clock. Everyone please come. So I'm listening, and all the little kids start walking after him, saying that, and they're making this procession around the yard. And I said to him, who's Yankel Cornfield, and what, okay, I'm making up the name. I said, who is he? What are you talking about? And he points to the sidewalk, and he says, that's the ant I just stepped on. I said, well, wow, okay. The Gemara said it, and I was wondering, like, does it ever happen? Now my kids did it in the front yard. What am I supposed to say? You know? They did it. I didn't teach them, okay? They did it. Okay? So I'm just saying, sometimes you read lines in Talmud and you say, why? You know, when I read the line in Talmud that Mordechai developed like a woman and nursed Esther, it seemed far-fetched to me. And then a few months ago, I read an article that when there's famine, about 40% of men have a hormonal shift and they can actually nurse like women. Blew my mind. Sounds like far-fetched, right? Never heard of that one before. But they went and they checked in Africa, and they checked in places that are struck with hunger, and they found that many, many men can develop that way. Now you read the Gemara differently. I always read that Gemara and wondered, what's the Gemara telling me? Like, I didn't think it meant literal. I didn't take it literally. I didn't think such things happened. Okay. So we see that this whole idea of shade, even though at first glance we have a very hard time with it, it appears in the Talmud, it appears in Halacha. There's even a commentary called Sror Hamor, and he says that the whole concept of tsaras, that white spot that shows up on the wall of a house, he says that's the shadim playing games with you. Okay, so where do shadim come from? So there's a Gemara. The Gemara says there's this creature called the tzavua. I don't know exactly what creature it is. It says the male of the tzavua, after 7 years, becomes an atalef. Atalef they translate today as a bat. Okay? And this type of bat called an atalef, after 7 years, becomes a creature called an arpad. I don't know exactly what that is. And the arpad, after 7 years, becomes a kimush. And the kimush, after 7 years, becomes a choach. Choach is a thorn bush, a specific thorn bush in the desert. And the choach, after 7 years, becomes a shade. And the Talmud even says that there's a part of a human spine that after 7 years evolves into a snake. So is any of this literal? We wouldn't think so, right? We'd think these are Kabbalistic concepts, but I don't know. So we move forward. Yes. That's not a choach. I don't think so. Okay, so if we look in Tractate Sanhedrin, the Talmud discusses Pharaoh's sorcerers, and it says that when Moshe did the plague of the lice, so then the sorcerers said, this is a finger of God. From here, the Talmud says, you see that Shadim cannot create something smaller than the size of a barley, a kernel of barley. The Rav Papa says, no, they can create ants too. They gather up little things and create ants. So there's many fantastic stories here about Shadim. We have a Medrash. The Talmud says in Tractate Erevin that after Adam ate from the forbidden fruit, so he told his wife, I need a break. And he spent 130 years in separation. I always say, you want to learn marriage? So look at Adam. He was married to his wife a total of a few hours, and then he needed a separation for 130 years before he could continue. Obviously, there's something to think about that. But 130 years, the Talmud says in Tractate Erevin, Adam would spend alone, but Shadim would come and sleep next to him and get pregnant from him. And he gave birth to Shadim. Doesn't sound so good. The Medrash says that when it comes to the Garden of Eden, all of Israel who are circumcised come to the Garden of Eden, because Hashem put His name upon us so that we would enter the Garden of Eden. How do we have Hashem's name upon us? The shin is in the nose. You guys remember we discussed that Sunday? That the bridge of the nostril on the two sides form a shin. The dalet is in the hand. You remember we discussed the Arizal, extending the hand, giving charity. That's the dalet. The yud is the circumcision. And that's why when a Jew passes away, there's an angel in charge of the Garden of Eden, takes every Jew that's circumcised and brings them to the Garden of Eden. And someone who's not circumcised, even though he has the other two letters of Hashem's name, but those other two letters, what do they form? Shade. That's what the Medrash says. And the Talmud says, the Medrash Tanhuma says, along comes a shade and takes a person who's not circumcised to Gehenim. Now that certainly sounds like the shade is some creature out there. It's not a figment of our imagination. Okay, are we allowed to talk to Shadim? Okay, now that we've analyzed two approaches as to what Shadim are and sources in both directions, are we allowed to talk to them? So Nachmanides says that there are three types of Shadim, okay? One, you have nations that worship angels. That's one type of paganism. Then you have nations that worship stars and the zodiac and luck. That's a second type of paganism. And the third type of paganism, says Nachmanides, are those that worship Shadim. So worshiping demons, you guys could tell me, I don't know which religions there are out there that worship demons. They are all, which, what'd you say?
Satanism,
okay. So,
there's a difference. There's a lot of atheists who they started their own satanic cults just as an affront to Christianity.
So okay.
They call themselves Satanists, then there are actual cults that do worship demons.
Okay. So Nachmanides says all this is encompassed in what the second of the commandments says: do not worship any force but me. So we are not permitted to address them. And now we go to the root of the matter. The Abarbanel, there was a great rabbi who lived a little before the Shulchan Aruch. His name was Don Yitzchak Abarbanel. Okay, he was a rabbi, but he was also appointed a lord. He was in the court of the king. Later on, his children were banished when they made, during the Crusades, at one point, they banished all the Jews from Portugal. And his grandson was abducted by the church, and his son wrote a book called The Vikuach, The Argument. His son wrote a book which discusses a conversation between people, almost like the Kuzari. But the purpose of the book was an argument about why Christianity is false. And he wrote the book in the hope that one day his own son, who was abducted by the church, would encounter that book and understand why that's not the way to go. But he did not have that pleasure of ever meeting his son again. So the Barbanel's own grandson was abducted by the Christian church. It was one day they were all out in shul, I think it was Rosh Hashanah. And while they were out in shul, the maid took the baby and fled. And the church used to give a very high reward to people who would abduct the Jewish baby and bring him to the church. And she fled to the church. They took her to another city, and as much as he tried to research, no one would tell him. Back to our story. So the Abarbanel wrote a fantastic commentary. Now the Abarbanel himself had to travel, and in his commentary, he sometimes writes, I started writing this commentary on this day, and at the end of the book, he writes, and I ended on this day. And sometimes you see he wrote the whole commentary on, let's say, Kings in a matter of 2 or 3 weeks. He didn't have a book with him. He's quoting from all over Chazal, and he's writing away without sources. Sometimes he quotes in the Gemara and he gets it wrong. Like he sometimes made mistakes. But he didn't have the text in front of him. He was doing it all on the run by heart. So the Abarbanel writes like this. He says, Maimonides writes, both in the Guide to the Perplexed and in his halachic work and in his commentary on Mishnah, that kishuv, sorcery, maaseh sheidim, all the different things people think they could do with demons, it's all nothing. It's all nonsense. It's all a product of a person's imagination. And there is no such existence as a shade other than in your mind. And these are all things that people's imaginations can conjure up. That's Maimonides' opinion. But, he says, I don't agree with him, says the Abarbanel, even though he ordinarily goes with the Rambam. He says, I don't think this is right. I think from the Torah we find that there are such a thing as Shadim, and I think we have many stories throughout Talmud that seem to indicate that it is, like Nachmanides writes, part of the wisdom of understanding the stars is also dealing with these things called Shadim. And he quotes from Rabbeinu Nisim. The Ran writes that there are these angels that Hashem created that punish people, and they are called Shadim. So now we have to understand, do I have to believe that there are Shadim, or can I say there are no Shadim? What am I supposed to, what approach should I take? So we go back to that Kabbalistic work, Maaseh Hashem, and he writes like this. He says, It doesn't matter whether you believe they existed or they don't exist. You can believe that shadim don't exist and they don't harm and nothing. That's okay. Whatever you want to approach, you can be with the Rambam on this. We're not yet done. Now it gets a little bit more interesting. There is a concept called the D-book. Any of you hear about a D-book? What's a D-book? So, let's see what a D-book is. So, our first encounter with a D-book is actually not in the quotes here. Okay. It's missing from the quotes here. We have the following story. There was a decree against the Jewish people in the days of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. Can I remember the story?
And it was the Roman person's daughter.
Yeah, but there's more to the story. Give me one second. I don't have it here in the quotes. Give me one second. Okay. So I'm trying to remember who it was. I think it was Rabbi Elazar or Rabbi Yossi, who was a very sharp student. And they said, who's going to go to the emperor to fight for the decree? So everyone started saying, we need someone who is very pious. And they looked in the direction of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. So Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai said, if my father Yochai were here, would you send me to endanger myself like that? So they said, yeah, but you're the right man. So then he said, okay, but I want Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yossi to come with me. So Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yossi said, if my father Rabbi Yossi were here, would you send me to danger like that? Fine. Rabbi Yossi said to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, okay, I'll send my son with you. I hope I'm getting the names right. It was Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. I think the student who went with him was Rabbi Elazar Rabbi Yossi, I'm pretty sure. And he said to him, promise me you won't punish my son. Promise me you won't punish my son. So he promised. Okay? They were traveling and they started talking in Torah. They asked a question. How do we know a certain part of the vermin? You remember we discussed our parts of dead vermin that defile and don't defile. What about their skin? They were discussing different aspects of the vermin. What makes a person defiled and what not? Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai tried to give a proof with his opinion. So this student was there and he mumbled. He said, what's he mumbling? And he mumbled a much better proof than Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai said. And when he mumbled it, he said it in a way that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai felt like he was knocking him. Like he came up with a much better proof for the answer. So Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai got upset and he keeled over. Rabbi Yossi is falling and he's grabbing his neck and he's holding on to his neck as something's causing him to choke. And as he's choking and gasping for air, one of the other people turns to Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and says, you promised his father you wouldn't punish him. So he says, oh, you're right. And it was some kind of, there's some kind of, I don't remember the name of the creature, that in the sea can like grab a person's throat. So it says he stepped on his throat and he vomited out that creature and Rabbi Yossi was healed. And just as that happened, they looked up to the mast and they see a shade. So they look up and they say, what are you doing here? So the shade says, I came to help you. So Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai started crying. He said, why are you crying? He says, my grandmother's maid gets an angel and I get a demon. My grandmother's maid, Sarah's maid, Hagar, gets an angel that comes numerous times to talk to her. But I get a demon. So the demon says, but I'm here to help. So Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says, okay, so what are you going to do? So he says, when you come to the emperor, I'm going to enter the emperor's daughter, and she's going to go mad, and you'll come and talk to me, and you'll tell me, Bartalmion, say, Bartholomew, Bartalmion, get out, and I'll have to listen to you, and then you'll guide me to get out of her pinky, and then when I get out, she'll let out a screech, and all the glass in the house will shatter. And then she'll be cured, and then the Roman emperor will feel like he owes you something, and you'll be saved. Okay? So, they land at the port, and the Roman emperor's daughter has gone mad. She's dancing all around the house, and she's crazy. And all the doctors can't cure her, and they tell them, they tell the Roman emperor, you know, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai is a smart rabbi, and he'll be able to cure your daughter. So they send a quick messenger out to Israel to say, send us Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. We hear he could cure the emperor's daughter. So they tell the messenger he's already en route. So the messenger comes back, and he tells the Roman emperor, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai will be here any minute. He's already en route. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai comes to the palace. They rush him in, and they bring him to the emperor's daughter. So he's ready for this, right? So he talks to the daughter, and he says, Shade, are you Bartalmion? You entered the girl? And the voice comes out of her throat and says, yes. And he says, well, I'm going to command you to leave, and I don't want you to harm her when you leave. You have to leave through her pinky. And the emperor asks Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, how do I know you're not a fake? How do I know it's real? So Rav Shimon Bar Yochai says, you'll see. When he exits through her pinky, she'll let out a shriek, and all the glass in your palace will shatter. And that's the next thing that happens. She lets out a shriek, and all the glass in the palace shatters, and she plops down, and then she's cured. So the emperor is thankful. He says to Rav Shimon Bar Yochai, tell me what you want. So he says, well, I want that decree. So he says, you can have it. And then he gives him a tour. And this is why the Talmud discusses what Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai saw in the Vatican. When we speak about the Vatican, and does the Vatican have the vessels from the Second Temple and the First Temple, so the Talmud says that as a show of appreciation, the emperor allowed Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai to go into all the Roman storage houses and see the loot from the temple. That was a show of appreciation. And then the Talmud has a discussion, what did he see? Because there are certain things that we're not sure about in Halacha, how they did it when they built the temple. So the Talmud says, well, why didn't Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai figure it out? He was there. He could have seen it. So that's a place where the Talmud quotes us a story of a D-book. Before we continue, I want to tell you another story. Our story happened 20 years ago, about 19, 20 years ago. 19, 20 years ago, I'm in yeshiva, and someone comes up to me and says, you won't believe it, there's a D-book. There's a woman up north that a shade went into her body. And I said, you're 100% right. He said, what do you mean? That I won't believe it. So he says, it's on record. The cameraman came. They took a video. This big Kabbalistic rabbi walked in, and he sat down, and it's all being taped and shown on TV. And the rabbi sat down, and he started talking to her, and this funny voice came out of her throat, and he asked her, who are you? And the voice said, I'm a demon. And the rabbi said, how do I know you're for real? And the voice said, well, this woman's son is doing drugs, and if you go check in the house under this and this carpet, you'll find his stash of drugs. And people went and checked, and they found his drugs. And then they asked the voice, and it said a whole bunch of other things. And they asked the voice who you should vote for in the coming elections. I said, you see? And he says, and he says, no, it was a big rabbi and a long white beard, and he's a huge Kabbalist, and it's all on video. And then he told the demon to go out of the pinky, and she let out a huge screech, and then her voice came back to normal, and she was normal. And I said, did they videotape all of this? The woman lying down, the rabbi talking to the woman. He said, yeah, it's all on videotape. I said, that's not a rabbi, and that's not a demon, and the whole story is a lie, and leave me alone. So the guy says to me, and you think you can contradict? And I remember, this is 19 years ago. I didn't even have a beard back then. And he says to me, who are you to say the guy is a fake? It's a big rabbi. You see, he's a Kabbalist. He could talk to demons. I said, no, I see he's a fake. And what he did is against halacha, and he cannot be a holy person if he acts against halacha. So he says to me, what's against halacha? I said, to videotape a woman lying down and project it to the whole world, just because he's supposed to be holy in this whole story, that's against halacha. In halacha, you don't go showing videos of women lying in bed. That's not modest. And if he's so holy, then he shouldn't have agreed to such a thing. Even if sometimes you're a holy person and you have to be a doctor and you deal with a patient that's lying in bed, you don't agree for videos of a woman lying in bed to be screened around the world. I don't buy it. That's not modest. If he's so holy, he wouldn't have allowed it. If he allowed it, it's a fake. So this person and a few other people who heard the conversation banned me. No more talking to Frankenthal. He doesn't honor rabbis. I said, he's not a rabbi. They said, you're not a rabbi. I said, I never said I was a rabbi, but that's not for real. Now, for the next few months, this video circulated. My younger brother was still in elementary school. They brought him a video to watch of the rabbi taking out a D-book. Needless to say, this man made millions. Millions off of this story. And of course, the party that everyone was told to vote for by this demon also made a nice advancement. And then, a year or so later, the woman comes to the press and says, it's all a fake. And the press says, what do you mean it's a fake? So the woman says, they paid me to do it, but they promised me more money and they promised me a larger percentage of the profits and they're not giving it to me. So now I'm going to give it all away. So they asked her, what do you mean? But there was that voice. And she said, I'll produce that voice right now. And they said, but what about the drugs? And she said, I knew where those drugs were all the time. So that was part of the ploy to make it believable. And then everyone suddenly realized there was a sham. Now, why am I telling you this? Because we're reading things here which you should wonder, hey, did this really happen? I don't know. We said that Maimonides understands none of this should be taken literally. Rambam says these things don't exist the way we think, the way we read them simplistically. Rambam learns that angels don't appear in physical form. So if Hagar is talking to an angel, that's a prophetic vision. She didn't see anything with her eyes. So then Rambam also learns that Shadim, in the sense that they're like angels, are also a matter, I don't know if you see it with your soul or your imagination, but you don't see it with your naked eye. They say the Chafetz Chaim took out a D-book. Maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know. But if the Chafetz Chaim told me he did it, I'm willing to believe him. If someone who I never heard of beforehand tells me he did it, and he does things that seem to contradict halacha, so then I don't believe it. Back to our story of a D-book. So our story number one is that story about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and the question is, do we understand it correctly or not? Next story. There was a man named Artivan. We will have to revisit this. Who is this Artivan? He sends Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, he sends him a very precious jewel, a very precious gem, and he tells him, I sent you something special. You send me something special. So Rabbi Yehuda Anasi, writes a mezuzah for Artivan, and he sends it to him. Artivan sends Rabbi a message back. He says to him, I sent you something that no appraiser in my area could give a value to it. It's so valuable. And you sent me something that's barely worth a dollar. You send me a little piece of parchment with what you wrote. I could buy a mezuzah here by any scribe. Rebbe sends back. He says to him, you sent me something that I have to watch over it. And I sent you something that will watch over you. The Pasuk says, Torah is more precious than jewels. Everything you have doesn't equal it. And that's where the story ends in some texts. There was a response called She'ilta de Rabbi Chai Gaon. One of the rabbis right after the period of the Talmud was called Rabbi Chai Gaon. He had a son who wasn't so good at learning, so he wrote a work for his son. On every parasha, he quotes them from all Gemaras from all over stories, and he tried to make the Torah more palatable to his son. And we benefit from it that we have these quotes that he wrote to his son, the She'ilta de Rabbi Chai Gaon. So in his work, he quotes a continuation to the story. And in the continuation, he writes, right away, a shade entered the house of Artivan. He had only one daughter. All the doctors came. No one could help her until Artivan took the mezuzah and put it up in his doorpost. And right away, that female shade ran away. And that's when Rebbe agreed to accept Artavan's gift. Meaning initially, Rebbe put Artavan's gift at bay. He said, what am I... he doesn't like my gift, I shouldn't take his gift. So in the Jerusalem Talmud and in the Medrash, this end of the story doesn't appear. Who is Artavan? Who is he? So, first of all, when we put up a mezuzah, it says, put up a mezuzah as far out as you could in the doorpost, because it affords you more protection. Rambam says those people who put up a mezuzah for protection, they're not doing the mitzvah. You don't put up a mezuzah for protection. Ah, but the halacha says it does give you protection, but that's not why you're putting it up. Okay? So, it protects you from shadim. You just saw that. Who is Artavan? It says in Shulchan Aruch, let's say you rent a house from a non-Jew, or you're renting a house to a non-Jew. You take out the mezuzah, you don't leave it in. The Maharil was asked, they had an officer, famous story. In this, there was, everyone knows of the Baal Shem Tov, right? So there was a city named Michelstadt, and their rabbi was known as the Baal Shem Tov of Michelstadt. The governor of the city of Michelstadt decided no one could put up mezuzahs on their doorpost. So the Baal Shem of Michelstadt went to meet with the governor of the city. And this was the time of Ben Franklin. This was just after Ben Franklin. So the Baal Shem of Michelstadt comes to the governor and he tells him, sir, you've undoubtedly heard that there's this great invention in the United States, this invention of a lightning rod. So he says, yes, but I'm not sure what it is. So he says, well, a lightning rod protects your house that it won't be hit by lightning. Let me tell you something. You'll never see a Jewish home with a lightning rod. Now, in the middle of Europe, lightning rods didn't just make it yet. So he says, okay. And he says, and you'll never show me a Jewish house that was hit by lightning. That's not such a far-fetched thing either. So the Baal Shem of Michelstadt tells them, we have something that works like a lightning rod. It's called a mezuzah. You put up a mezuzah, and you see that all your houses will be safe, and you'll have good income from us. You collect taxes from us. And the governor bought it. He said, fine, you're right. I never saw a Jewish house hit by lightning, and I never saw a Jewish house with a lightning rod. Must be it works. And he annulled his decree. They were allowed to put up mezuzahs. But the Maharil, who was a big halachic authority in Ashkenaz, was asked, the governor, they needed to placate him, and they wanted to give him a mezuzah. If they give a mezuzah to the governor of the city, so then he wanted one very badly, so all the Jews have this protection by their door. He asked the Jews to give him, are they allowed to give him that? And he promised them that for the rest of his life, he'll do good to the Jews if they give him a mezuzah. And if they don't, then who knows what'll happen? And the Maharil said, don't give him a mezuzah. The Maharil said, we don't give that sacred Jewish writing to a non-Jew. No. So then the question, so if you think the non-Jew's going to hate them and make a pogrom, obviously you could give him a mezuzah. But the question that's discussed is, what happened here when Rebbe gave that mezuzah to Artavan? Who was this Artavan? One opinion says he was a non-Jewish Persian king. There's a Persian king that appears in our text that's called Artavan. So if it was a Persian king, so then why, if Rebbe could send him a gift like that just to make him happy, so certainly you could give a non-Jew a mezuzah. Others say no, Artavan was a Jewish scribe. We find in other sources that there was a Jewish scribe, a Jewish sofer named Artavan. And that's why he writes back to Rebbe. He says, I write mezuzahs. What do I need your mezuzah for? What did you just give me? To which Rebbe answered him. There was a famous story under the President Weizmann where he gave a Torah scroll to maybe to Eisenhower? Who did he give a Torah scroll to? Maybe to Eisenhower, I don't remember. I think, what? Or to Truman? I don't remember. And a lot of people discussed this question, how do you give a non-Jew a Torah scroll? So, now we come to the conclusion. Bottom line, so in Shulchan Aruch, it says like this. On Shabbos, there are all kinds of things that people do when a person's wounded or a person gets into depression. And there are things that people write called Kameya. And the Shulchan Aruch over there writes, all these things that people think will affect the person they'll help him, they'll cure him, and they're all based on all kinds of spiritual, I wouldn't say spiritual, superstitious things like Shadim. Shulchan Aruch says, you're allowed to do it on Shabbos because people believe it will cure them. The truth is, it's nonsense. So the Shulchan Aruch rules like the Rambam. The Shulchan Aruch actually says that all this idea of Shadim, it's all in your mind. But he says, you know what? Psychosomatics also works. A guy's lying and he thinks he's dying. And you come and you do, oh, I have a great story to tell you. In Yemen, a Yemenite neighbor told me this. He said, true story, his uncle, so his great uncle, his uncle's father, was known as a doctor, and even the Arabs honored him. So one day an Arab lady shows up, and she shows up with her cow that's half dead, and she says, my cow's half dead, here are her symptoms, I need you to cure the cow. So his great uncle tells his uncle, who was a kid, he tells the lady, I'll send my son over and we'll cure her. So he tells the kid, go over to the house, have her fill a bucket as high up with water as she can, then sit down next to her and ask her, what is the cow's name? She tells you the cow's name, you write it down 7 times. Then you ask her, what was her mother's name? And you write that 7 times. And then you ask her, what was the cow's grandmother's name? And she might have to go and ask her mother what the cow's grandmother's name. And you write that down 7 times. Then you write what the cow's children's names are 7 times. When you finish doing all that, you scratch all that ink into the water, and you tell her, let the cow drink and she'll be cured. So the kid goes over, and he sits down, and he says, my father sent me, told me exactly what to do. He brings parchment, he brings ink. And he sits down and he asks this Arab lady, what's the cow's name? She tells him, he writes down 7 times. What's the mother's name? Writes it 7 times. Grandmother's name? She runs to her mother, she gets the name, he writes it 7 times. What are each child's name? Writes it down. Then he says, okay, now that you've told me all that, he erases it all into the water. He says, let the cow drink this and she'll be cured. The cow drinks, 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 drinks. And the next day the lady comes with money and she says, it worked. Your cure worked, Rabbi, you're a holy man, even your son's holy, and she pays them and she goes home. So the kid says to his father, he says, what did we just do? What, explain this one to me. What did we just do? So he said, well, the cow was dying of dehydration. But welcome to the business. He said, if I would have told the lady, go home and give your cow to drink water, she wouldn't have listened to me. She thought she needed a doctor. I could have just said, go give her to drink. But just like she didn't give the cow to drink until now, she wouldn't have given the cow to drink. That cow needed a lot to drink. And I would have told her, give her more to drink, she wouldn't have listened to me. So like this, I sent you, you did it. She drank and drank and drank. The cow's cured, the woman's happy, everyone's happy. And you convinced her to make the cow drink. Sometimes you have to talk their language. Says the Shulchan Aruch, you think I'm telling you a story about an Arab lady. Shulchan Aruch says it about us. The Shulchan Aruch says, when a person's lying and they're ill or dying, and they believe that when you'll say the name of this demon or that demon and write this inscription, that inscription, they'll be cured, psychosomatics work. And the Shulchan Aruch says, that's why it's mutar on Shabbos. The Shulchan Aruch rules like the Rambam. Right away the commentaries say, that's not right. The Gra comes out against the Shulchan Aruch and the commentary say, we have so many sources, I quoted some of them tonight, we have so many sources that say that there are forces out there. You can't just say it's a matter of a person's mind. And so the Halacha really concludes with the Machlokas. We end up with the Shulchan Aruch seeming to rule, in Aruch Haim, he seems to rule, that it's all a matter of your mind. Now all of you should ask me, what about what we learned earlier from Tractate Gittin? What about the fact that when a woman needs to be divorced, we say you have to verify it wasn't the demon that spoke to you. So we would have to interpret that the way the Rambam does. That we're worried a guy's out in the desert and he's seeing a mirage and he's hearing voices, but it has nothing to do. We're not worried that an angel appeared there. We're worried about his mind playing tricks on him. We know that happens. And so at the end of the day, we end up with the Shulchan Aruch, it seems, rules that it's all a matter of our mind. And the Gra argues right away very strongly against the Shulchan Aruch. We saw that there are two opinions. Well, it ends up with two opinions. Any questions?
Just to clarify, the Shulchan Aruch says you could write and do that on Shabbos to save
a person's life. Right. The person believes in it. Right. So Shulchan Aruch says we allow you to do it not because it works,
right. But
because he believes it works. And part of curing a person is getting them to believe that they're going to be better. That's.
But that doesn't. I don't necessarily understand that. That would imply that it doesn't exist. The Shulchan Aruch could say it works through psychosomatics, but also there could be a real.
So we have to look it up. I don't have the wording here. I don't know why I don't have it in my printout. The exact wording of the Shulchan Aruch. I don't have a Shulchan Aruch here. We could look it up later. If you bring a Mishnah Berurah, it's Chelek Gimel. If you bring a Shulchan Aruch, it's Chelek Beis. Depends on what. Yes.
Two questions. Is the name Shed related to the name of Hashem somehow?
We discussed that earlier. Yes.
Can you finish the story about the Bar Yochai?
That's the end of the story.
What?
He was given certain gifts. He was entitled to see all the vessels. And he came home with a chest full of jewels. He was given a lot of gifts.
What's the difference between a shade and a devut? You get two sources. They seem like the same thing.
A debuk seems to be a shade that enters a person. Yes.
So I've been discussed earlier, but male and female?
We didn't go into that. The verse seems to say that. Asiti li sheidim
v'sheidot. How does the Rambam answer that, and what does that mean?
I'm not sure how Rambam would answer that.
That seems specifically said that there is something.
Could be in a man's imagination. Sometimes he imagines men, sometimes he imagines women. I don't think that's so far-fetched for the Rambam to say that. Yes, yeah, cool.
Doesn't Rav Caro have like a sefer the learning that he did with Malach?
With Malach. Malach is a different story, but if it's all a matter of my mind, well, with Malach you can connect with your neshama, and a shade could be that's a figment of a person's imagination. It's his fears. It's very real. For some reason you think that if I'm talking about something in a person's mind that makes it not real. Let me tell you a story. I had a friend who was very successful at everything he did, but he was also very pressured to succeed. And one day, they found him trying to commit suicide. And we became aware that he obviously was too pressured to succeed. And I went to speak to him like a few weeks afterwards. Things were a little calmer. And he said to me, I'm getting help, I'm getting treatment. But when a person has an illness, so then there's me, and then the person knows they have to fight the illness. But when a person has a psychological challenge, so then they're fighting themselves, they have to deal with themselves. I'm the problem. It's my mind's the problem, that's me. When a person has a psychological challenge, when a person hears voices or sees demons, and it seems this could happen to people who are like anyone, that's not a small thing. For whatever reason, you guys seem to take it that if it's a matter of our minds, so then it's not real. That's very real. When a person feels like when a person hears voices, to them that's very real. That's their reality. It's not less severe. In a certain sense, it's more severe. Okay, give me 1 second. Let's see the Lashon of the Shulchan Aruch. could be it's in Yeredeya, by the laws of idol worship. Could be it's over there. Over there by the dinim of okay, I'll look it up when we take a break. Say that. I think it's over there by the Isur of Nichush. I think over there he writes that. I think so. I don't see it here. I think that's where it's over there in Yerden, not here. I'm not finding it, so I think that's where it is.
Yeah, no. I wanted to make sure I wasn't missing like the logical conclusion that it could, even though the Shulchan Aruch could rule that it's in the mind and you could save somebody on Shabbos, it doesn't necessarily imply that it could also exist in.
Let's see his wording there. I think it's right there. I think it's in your day. It's not here.
You'll get it?
When we take a break.
Okay, good.
I don't see it here. I guess it's there. Okay.